Tonight on Arena, Clemency, Spaceship Earth and Arkansas are the movies up for review, and poet Susanna Dickey on her debut novel, Tennis Lessons. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. And it's films first this evening, and three up for your consideration. First is Clemency, a drama that brings us into the dark heart of the American criminal justice system as it explores a prison warden's crisis of confidence. Spaceship Earth is a documentary about Biosphere 2, a man-made, self-contained mini-planet established in the Arizona desert in 1991. And Arkansas is a slice of Southern fried noir written and directed by Clark Duke, starring, amongst others, Liam Hemsworth, Vince Vaughn and John Malkovich. Joining me are Arlene Hunt and Chris Wasser. We'll start with Clemency. This revolves around prison warden Bernadine Williams. Who is she? It's based on a true life story here, Arlene.
It is. It's based on the story of Troy Davis, who was put to death basically in Savannah, Georgia, in 2011. And he was convicted of murdering a police officer called Mark MacPhail. And so essentially this is a loosely based on the death of Troy Davis, but it's more about Bernadine than it is about Davis. It's their characters are very interconnected, but it's really to do with the weight of everything that Bernadine has to take on board to become who the person that she is. She is basically the governor of a jail, one of the few jails in the area that allows the death penalty. And she's gone through, I think this is number 13. This will be her, Woods is going to be number 13. And by the time she gets to number 13, everything about this woman is starting to fall apart.
It has the most, I don't know what adjective to use, in fact, Chris Wasser, to describe the opening sequence in this film.
The opening scene is quite remarkable, Sean, you're right. The opening sequence involves Bernadine, who has been informed that an execution will take place, that the governor has been in touch to say it can go ahead. The inmate is brought into the execution room. The curtain is still up. You know, you have family and relatives of the inmate and the person who they have murdered on the other side. But the execution, how to put it, it starts to go wrong. Basically, the medical staff can't locate a vein, and it takes an awful lot longer than it should. And if tensions weren't high enough for Bernadine, and indeed the audience watching us, it just lingers for longer than it should as they attempt to locate a vein. And for a large part of this sequence, and again you see this throughout much of the film later on too, we focus on Bernadine's face, and just focusing on Bernadine's face, played by Alfred Woodard, we see that this probably hasn't happened before, but this is probably the straw that breaks the camel's back. This is all too much. And already she was having a crisis of confidence and a crisis in herself about, you know, do I really want this profession anymore?
And I suppose one of the things that particular sequence shows us, which comes back later again in the movie, is this whole idea of how absolutely regimented an execution is. The carrying out, there are specific things that happen at very specific times, and it's all very clear. And in fact, in the clip we're about to hear, you'll hear Alfred Woodard describing to a man who's about to be executed just exactly some of the protocols that will be involved.
4 hours from the execution, all communication with outside parties will cease. That includes Miss Lametta, friends, family members, but you can be with the chaplain the entire day, all the way through the procedure. You will have to take your clothes off, wear the shirt, the pants, the shoes issued to you. When it's time for the procedure, you will be walked to the chamber, where five officers will restrain you to the gurney. A medical professional will prepare you for your injection. Officer will insert the metazolin. That will render you unconscious. The second drug is pancuronium bromide, which causes paralyzation. The last drug is potassium chloride, which will cease heart function. At that point, medical personnel will confirm the execution complete. Now, if you want to talk to Mr. Lametta about this later, you can, but do you have any questions? Do you have any family that would like to claim your body? If there are no family members that wish to claim your body, your remains will be laid to rest in a plot here on our property, owned by the state.
That's Alfred Woodard as Bernardine Williams, warden in a high security prison where executions are carried out. And there she was explaining it. In fact, to Anthony Woods, as played by Aldous Hodge, he silent throughout that particular sequence and silent in much of the film, it has to be said as well. Arlene Hunt and Chris Wasser are reviewers this evening. Does this at any point start to debate or to get into the debate around the death penalty itself, Arlene?
I don't feel it does. I mean, it's a very complex film and it's very heavy in characterization, but it doesn't offer up anything about the rights or the wrongs of the death penalty, only from what you can draw from yourself. As Chris said, the opening scene, it was such a devastating, for her it was a dereliction of duty, because that's how she is. Everything should have gone by the book. Everything should have been correctly followed to the point where death would have been instantaneous and there would have been no thing. But as it turned out, steps were missed. Like, for the reason why Hernandez died in the first scene so horrifically is because he didn't drink enough water that day. I mean, it's such a tiny little detail in the film, but it stuck with me for ages afterwards. He didn't drink enough water, so it was difficult to find a vein. I mean, these are all the steps, step by step to lead to. But even as you can see hear in that clip, the way she's talking about this, it's sanitized. Talking about a man's death. He's going to his death.
But isn't that part of the point here? How can she go in full of emotion to the man who's about to use his life? How dare she, in fact, be full of emotion? Her job is at that point to be absolutely clinical in her description of what is going to happen to the prisoner.
That's her professional life. But when you see the fallout from this then in her private life, because no human being can walk through life and say this is black and white and then not have to worry about the rest of the alphabet of your life.
And that's where it goes then, Chris. It starts looking at how that clinical nature, that clinical professionalism that she has to show in that situation, how that affects her outside of work.
It does, because outside of work, she's clearly developed a drinking problem. And rather than going home to her husband after work, she has started to have a drink or several with a colleague, Thomas, played by Richard Gunn. And some of the times, you know, she's stumbling in, and maybe her husband, played by Wendell Pierce, Jonathan, he's actually a high school teacher and he's a world away from what's going on in his wife's life. You know, she's gone to bed and they don't really communicate with one another. And on their anniversary then, which she's actually forgotten, he, you know, surprises her with drinks upon arrival. He tries to make sure that they have a lovely evening, but their marriage, the love between them, is just crumbling. And I thought that this aspect of the film was quite interesting, and I liked how it went into Anthony Woods' a personal life, the life that he had before he was arrested, before he ended up in prison. The only thing is, when we get down to the nitty gritty, when we get down to the characters talking to one another, for instance, Jonathan talking to his wife, the things that they said to one another, it all just started to sound very cliched and formulaic. And the way they spoke about their relationship crumbling, the best way I can describe it is it's theatre talk. You know, there's stuff about, you know, I feel like we're in fragments. I want us to be whole again. Well, you can be whole with someone else. I just thought, I want this, if we're going to make it as authentic as possible when Bernadine is in her work and when she has to talk the way she talks to the prisoners, attention should be paid then to how people would actually talk to one another at home. So that was a bit of a problem for me.
And we also get the defence lawyer here, or the appeals lawyer, Richard Sheaf, playing the part of Marty Lametto, and we get the chaplain is mentioned there as well. He comes in to play as well. Does, in fact, and is the problem here down to, for you, because I think it is a problem for both of you, Chinonye Chukwu, if that's how I say the director's name, is the problem down to the choices made directorially for you, Arlene? Is there too much being done here?
Yeah, there's a lot of weight on Alfred Woodard. There's a lot of weight on her face. There's a lot of weight on Aldous Hodge's face, you know, and they're amazingly emotive actors. But for me, and I will agree with Chris on this, like, I thought a lot of the dialogue that was outside of the prison was very stilted. And for me, like, she's clearly a furious woman and she's trying to hold it together. She's very angry. And at one point she does say to her husband, you know, you can't possibly understand what I'm going through, which I think is actually true, because he's a high school teacher. How would he comprehend what this woman goes through on a day-to-day basis? But that's the last line we hear of that. And then, you know, he moves into a motel. And I would have loved this film to have a slightly more balanced look at the devastating cost of the choices of her employment. You know, because that's really important, and that seems to me. Yeah.
It did strike me that if it had been a fiction, maybe they could have gone there. Maybe because it had a basis in true in reality, that there were problems around kind of going that direction. I'm not sure.
Genuinely, I think they were so cautious, they were so cautious about not offending, because this is based on a loosely on a real story with real victims. I think there's an element of caution to it. You know, that they were afraid to stretch too far into the different narratives.
So, stars from you in this case, Arlene Hunt?
Given it 3 out of 5, it was a really interesting film, but it could have given us so much more.
And from you, Chris?
I think the performances are great. Alden Hodge in particular, who I've only seen in romantic comedies and horrors, I thought he was great here, but he was making more out of the material that he was given. The material for him wasn't great, so it was the writing that let it down. And also, at times, it felt a bit too like an ordinary television movie of the week. So great performances. It was the screenplay that let it down. So I'm going to have to go with 2.5 out of 5.
And like the other two movies this evening, it's almost 2 hours long. I don't know who has the facility to stick with something like that, unless it really grips you. It has to be, it has to be fully there to hold you for 2 hours without you dozing off, like I found myself doing, even though I found it very engaging. Let's move on then to Spaceship Earth, directed by Matt Wolfe. I suppose, talk to me about Biospherians, if you would, Chris Wasser.
Well, Sean, I just yesterday learned that Biospherians were real people and that Biosphere 2 was a real thing in the early 90s. And I'm not sure how I let this pass me by.
I know.
But long story, I don't know, were you the same? Did you know about this, Sean?
I knew nothing about it. I want to know everything about it now.
You know, and honestly, I've come across a few pieces where reviewers have said, they thought this was just one big send-up, but it's not. This really happened. In 1991, you had 8 people who entered this extraordinarily large dome in the middle of the Arizona desert, and it was known as Biosphere 2 because the Earth is Biosphere 1. And it was it was the brainchild of this, self-proclaimed genius and
John
eco,
Allen.
John Allen, this guy who started up a commune essentially in the 1970s, and he had this dream of what it would be like to basically bring silent running to life, to basically see what humans would be like if they built their own ecosystem, if they built their own dome, and if they lived in it, and how could they survive, first of all, to try it out on Earth, but how could they, if that was successful, to try it on other planets in the future.
You mentioned Silent Running there was a fictional film that dealt with that did this precisely. It was kind of a science fiction story, wasn't it?
Yes, 1972 science fiction, Douglas Trumbull. Great story, but you had a lot of domes in space. With this, it was an idea to build this dome in the Arizona desert. But you're thinking to yourself, to do something like that, to make this enormous glass and steel structure, you're going to need a lot of money. And somehow,
they had money.
Along the way, John Allen befriended a billionaire by the name of Ed Bass, who used his family's oil money to make this a real thing.
All right. It is an extraordinary story. Let's listen to a few of the Biospherians. They'll mention John Allen in the midst of all of this, but the first person you're going to hear from is a desert ecologist, Tony Burgess, who was very excited when he heard about the project.
John said, "We're going into the space race." I said, "What?" He said, "Yeah, we're going to build this thing called the biosphere that's a prelude to extraterrestrial biospheres. And so we want you to design the desert." I was working at the University of Arizona Desert Laboratory. And, well, you know, compared to the normal academic career, compare that to launch humanity into an extraterrestrial evolutionary trajectory. It was visionary.
A nice, simple definition that I like of a biosphere is a virtually closed system with plants and animals and the atmospheres all inside. If we're going to build the first human-designed biospheric system, we're going to make it beautiful. We're going to put in mini rainforest, a desert, the savanna, an ocean with a living coral reef. Would be populated by hundreds of carefully selected plants and animal species, including 8 people. We called the project Biosphere 2 because we wanted people to say, well, where's Biosphere 1? Biosphere 1 is the Earth.
There you go. A clip from Spaceship Earth and the Biospherians that you heard there. Tony Burgess, the desert ecologist, who is great, really looking forward to getting out of the university lecturing and getting into the space race. And Mark Nelson was the other character that we heard in the midst of all of that. He has a very interesting nickname. They all have interesting nicknames. Mark Nelson's nickname is Horse Something. I think you can work out what the second part of that phrase was. They're extraordinary characters, and there are as many women involved in this. Kathleen Grace Salty, Marie Harding Flash are two of the women that we hear a lot from. The extraordinary characters, Arlene.
Yes, that's one way of looking at them. They're slightly bonkers. I just think of them as capitalist hippies. By the end of the movie, I was thinking capitalist hippies. You know, they had their hearts in the right place, but, you know, they're funded by, you know, Ed Blass is a multi-billionaire at that point. You know, their ideology is pretty sound. You know, they're looking for a way to recreate the Earth's environment in an enclosed, self-sufficient ecosystem. But, you know, the first half of the movie deals pre-Arizona, you know, where they're sort of coming from this kind of hippie communes, and they're learning, and they you know, they have a boat and they go out in the sea and they're learning to be self-sufficient, and it's great. But when they go into the commune, when they go into the ecosystem, you know, I wish we had stayed more with that, because it's pretty obvious from the archival photographs and videos that we have that things fell apart fairly quickly. And we don't get enough of that information throughout this documentary, because by the time those eight people had walked out of there after 2 years, because they were enclosed for 2 years, I mean, they'd lost maybe 13, 14% of their body weight. Most of them weren't even talking to each other anymore. And they were suffering enormously from a lack of oxygen. So they had to break the rule of the ecosystem and have oxygen pumped back in. And there's a beautiful little scene in it where Mark Nelson actually is talking about the change in their bodies, the change in their mentality. As soon as they started to get enough oxygen, they were suddenly dancing and running around each other and hugging and stuff. Because they were starved of everything. They were starved of nutrients. They were starved. They hadn't even enough to breathe. So it was just, I'd love to have seen a little bit more of things going wrong.
Yeah, there was another scene where they talked about the problem with birthday cakes when you don't have sugar, butter, not too many eggs, and everything is made from bananas.
Banana.
Yeah. Banana wine they had as well, but it never fermented enough for them to realise just how tasty it was or wasn't. But it did strike me, Chris, just as, first of all, like you said, I thought, is this actually a wind-up? Is it a fiction? But no, it was a documentary. But it takes so long to get going. Mm-hmm. Again, it's 2 hours long. Could we not have cut to the chase and got into the nitty-gritty of what went on or didn't go on inside the enclosed space? Was that really not where the interest was?
I agree, yeah. I think you could actually cut half an hour from it, and it does have an awful habit of repeating itself. At one point, I wanted to throw something at the screen every time they mentioned the fact that the oxygen might run out. It's like, okay, we get that. We want to explore this more. And I kind of got the feeling that Matt Wolff, who has interviewed all of the surviving members...
Is it the director, Matt Wolff? Yeah, yeah.
And most of them actually... And the director, Matt Wolff, he wanted to... most of the members of the Biosphere 2 team, they actually participated in it. There was just a couple that didn't. I kind of get the feeling that Wolf was stalling a little bit throughout this film, because there are things which he doesn't lean into, and I kind of feel as though he's holding back on John Allen a bit, because the longer this film goes on, you start to realise that John Allen might not be all he's cracked up to be. And, you know, the Biospherians and his co-workers, they all hold him up as this godlike figure, which is why the one word that kept coming to me throughout this was cult. It is a cult. Whatever way you look at it, it's a bunch of free thinkers and hippies from the 1960s who befriended a billionaire and created their own little world. And they do, before they went in there, they lived, on a planet of their own. And I wanted to know more about this John figure. And I wanted to hear from other scientists who would say, I mean, at one point we're just told that other scientists who had started to work on the project said, look, this is not real science. It's more like eco-entertainment. And they walked away. I wanted to know more about that. Why wasn't this being taken seriously? Saying that, the scenes in which the project all of a sudden becomes, basically a PR person becomes involved and this thing hits mainstream American media. Those scenes are just glorious, because what you're actually seeing is, everyone says that it was like the space race. To watch it all of these years later, you're thinking, actually, that looks like the very first Big Brother is what it looks like. But I'm not surprised that you put these eight people...
Yeah, but it all, as well as that Big Brother aspect, it also turns into, which I thought was where the interest in the film possibly lay, Arlene, it turns into a debate around climate change and around destroying the planet.
Now, I would take Chris's half hour that he cut out from the first half of this movie, and I would add in half hour of Steve Bannon towards the end of this movie. That's where it gets really interesting for me. Steve Bannon, fresh from Goldman Sachs, suddenly pops up in this as a good friend of Ed Bass and basically shunts John Allen and Marguerite Augustine over to one side and takes over essentially the running of this place. The scientific handbrake is on now because Steve Bannon suddenly comes into it. And it's really interesting to see how the biospherians have no concept of how to deal with someone like him, someone who is coming from from a very different angle from what they're coming from.
Not many people would be able to handle Steve Bannon, I think.
And but they even say themselves, like, he's so incredibly intelligent, but he has an agenda from the word go. And it's really interesting to see someone like him, knowing what we know now in 2020, to see a young Steve Bannon wiggle his way into sort of the power and the money and everything like that, you know. And he's very young in this. He's only a young man in this, but you can still see the glint. I was just thinking to myself, you know, evil has a long shelf life. It really does.
stars from you, first of all, Chris.
Look, it is flawed, but it is almost like the project itself, an enjoyable piece of entertainment, and also an unusual lockdown documentary at that. And I'm all about the half stars tonight, but we'll go with 3.5. I just wish it had been that little bit shorter, and I also wish we would have explored John Allen, who, by the way, Sean, and for listeners, John Allen didn't actually participate in the experiment itself, and that's something that should have been explored too.
Yeah, he was outside watching it, as it were. And from you, Arlene?
I'm going to give it 3 out of 5. Like Chris, I would have liked to have seen more of the puppet master and less of the puppets, but I also would have liked to have seen a lot more of what happened afterwards when the biospherians moved out of their 2-year holding pattern and see what happened after that, because it's been taken over by the University of Arizona, and I'd like to know what happened to the science, because at the end of the day, despite the fact that it wasn't, it was eco-entertainment, there was a lot discovered there. There was a lot of interest there, and I'd love to know what happened with that. How did it progress?
Okay, let's move on to our final film, Arkansas, a crime caper set deep in the Deep South, stars Liam Hemsworth and Vince Vaughn and John Malkovich. Just give us the basis of what's involved here. Again, nearly 2 hours of film, Chris Wasser.
We'll make it as simple as possible because this is actually complicated, Sean. But Liam Hemsworth, handsome Liam Hemsworth, is handsome Kyle, who is a lowly drug dealer who, for reasons we don't really understand, he works for this mysterious figure known as Frog. And one night he gets a promotion and ends up on the road to Arkansas. And when he's on the road to Arkansas, he partners up with another young guy, an annoying hipster named Swin, Clark Duke, who's starring in this film, produced it, directed it, co-wrote it, more of him later. And they're moving up the ranks in Frog's business. They also encounter a ranger on the road, played by John Malkovich, and it's his job to get them jobs, you know, get them jobs posing as his help on his park. But the real work that they will be doing is trafficking drugs all around America's South. And that's a very simple setup, but it gets very complicated with, you know, within the first half an hour when people start dying and when the young guys are actually end up on the wrong side of their mysterious boss.
Yeah, and they meet lots of people along the way, including the one that we're going to hear in this clip, who's simply called Her, played by Vivica A. Fox, and it's Liam Hemsworth and Clark Duke, who are the aforementioned Kyle and Swin.
I can't wait to die. Be a lot simpler if I could kill myself, but that's a sin, and I ain't going to hell. I'm waiting on the Lord to strike me down.
Smart.
Yes, Father, your will, your way. Take me, Father. Yes, Father.
So, the packet.
Don't be rude.
Don't be rude. There's a way to treat a lady.
Thank you. Where's the ranger?
He went to Oklahoma with an Indian.
What kind of car did the Indian drive?
I think it might have been a Kia. Could have been a Hyundai.
Just say, how should I know? I like boys like y'all that don't get hung up on having a long life. Say thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Should we go?
Yeah.
Okay.
Liam Hemsworth, Clark Duke and Vivica A. Fox in a scene there from Arkansas. I don't know about you, Arlene, but when I saw some of the, when I saw Vince Vaughn and when I saw Michael Kenneth Williams, when I saw John Malkovich, when I saw those in the cast, I thought, oh, this could be good. And when it started, I thought, oh, this is going to be good. And then I watched
then
the film.
Happened?
Then I watched
what,
the film.
What happened?
Yeah. What happened for you?
What happened for me is I just, my eyes almost rolled out of the back of my head, across the floor, out the door, down the bottom of the garden and into next door's garden. That's how I felt about it after
that's
about...
That's like a scene from the film.
I know.
That is like a scene from the film.
Hip dialogue to go with it. I'm sorry. I apologise in advance. This is a mess, to be honest with you. I haven't disliked a movie like this for so long that I'm almost at a loss as to explain how I feel about it. To be perfectly honest with you, this, like, there's so many problems with it. Clark Duke is clearly besotted with Tarantino, and that's fine. There's a lot of people that really like Tarantino, but this is not an homage to Tarantino. This is Pound Store Tarantino at its worst. Yeah. It's really awful. It really upset me, actually, in places. You know, it's all of the worst things about Tarantino as well, because at least Tarantino at some point can tell a story. This is like scenes that are all titled and chapters that are titled. There's a lot of shots of bare feet, which really annoyed me. At one point, Malkovich says, for no reason at all, that his feet were described as Christ-like. And then he answers the phone with his bare feet, even though he has two working hands. And that really annoyed me very much.
I think you touched on it earlier when you said, Chris, written by, starring, directed by and produced by Clark Duke. Is that the problem?
But there's a lot of problems, Sean, but that's the big problem. And I'm not sure how Clark Duke managed to convince, you mentioned that cast earlier.
Yeah.
When I saw that cast sheet, I thought, great, this is going to be solid at the very least. I'm not sure how he convinced these guys to be in it. And it's not as though Clark Duke has had a prolific or even a celebrated and acclaimed career as an actor. He's been, you know, he's played side parts in, you know, in comedies like Sex Drive and Kick-Ass. And he's not that great an actor, to be perfectly honest. So I'm not sure how he did it. Maybe everyone owed him a favor. That's a mystery in and of itself. I think the problem is, as Arlene has already talked about, it's as though Clark, you know, watched a couple of Martin McDonagh films, watched a couple of Coen pictures, and then topped it off with a Quentin Tarantino, you know, marathon, and completely misunderstood what it is about those features that makes them work, which is the storytelling.
Yeah.
And although this film is based on a novel, his adaptation of it is just such a mess. There are no characters, there are just sketches. The plot kind of runs around in circles. The dialogue
is appalling. There's no tension.
And there's no tension whatsoever. That's correct, yeah.
Are there any stars, Chris, from you?
I just think this is, it's a vanity project, and I think Duke just shows himself to be as much a chancer in the director's chair as he is in front of the camera. And again, some of the cast do try to make it work. John Malkovich is, you know, tearing up the scenery as usual, and Liam Hemsworth is trying to have his big serious acting moment.
Yeah.
But the material is just appalling. So it's just a mess. I'm going to have to go with one, Sean.
One from you. And what are you saying, Arlene Hunt?
I'm not giving any stars. I'm going to call Clark and I'm going to ask him for stars back. Just no stars for this movie for me. I'm sorry.
Zero from you. All right. And we got through that without saying Liam Hemsworth is the brother of Chris. Oh, no, we didn't. There we go. Clemency, Spaceship Earth,
almost there.
And Arkansas are the three films that Arlene Hunt and Chris Wasser were speaking to us about this evening. Tennis Lessons is the debut novel from award-winning poet Susanna Dickey. It charts one young woman's turbulent course to adulthood from the age of 3 to almost 29. Susanna Dickey joins me now from Belfast. You know, I was thinking about my first question being, tell me who this young woman is, but I suppose you wouldn't have written a 240-page novel or thereabouts, Susanna, if you could tell me who the young woman was succinctly in a sentence or two. So maybe I should ask you, where did this novel start? What did it start from? Was it a word? Was it a bit of dialogue? Was it an image?
Hello, by the way.
How are you?
I'm well. I just heard an ad in the break for ideal bathrooms, and it kept saying, you know, everyone should have an ideal bathroom. And now I'm wondering what an ideal bathroom is. I mean,
It's the start of novel number two, perhaps.
I mean, if I had an ideal bathroom, it would take me, I guess, 5 to 6 years into the past, and I would right all the wrongs that I've done people. That's what I'd like my ideal bathroom to do.
Oh, what a nice idea.
Anyway, so the novel, I guess I'm wondering what it sort of sprung from. I just, you know, I had this character in my head who... I guess what I wanted to do was, you know, I wanted to write somebody who, from an external vantage point, might seem kind of entirely ordinary, but whose idiosyncrasies and experiences and kind of alienation from her own body ensures that she can never see herself as that. Because, I mean, ultimately for me, the saddest part about the book is that nothing that happens to her is so, you know, remarkably awful. People experience these sorts of things and much worse and much weirder every day. And it's just kind of about trying to sort of siphon contentment from the innocuous. So, you know, I had... Tell me once you want me to stop talking.
No, that's fine. That's fine. No, I like this idea that you, because it was actually one of the things that I'd chosen out that you say I chosen from the book. The way that the book was written, we get it almost as if they're like diary entries. We get the age of the narrator and we get a month, you know, and it's not every month, it's not every year. Well, I think it is possibly every year, more or less from 3 through until 29. I think we get an entry for every year along the way, but certainly not every month and every year or anything like that. But when she's 13, she says to us, you want to read about normal people trying to do normal things. This is when she was in class reading books about something, usually about war and children at war. Was that Susanna Dickey's experience reading at school or reading elsewhere? Did you think, I don't want to read about all these highly dramatic things in some ways. I want to read about a normal, an ordinary person.
Yeah, I just kind of wanted a guide to life. I mean, my favourite book for a long time was the Argos catalogue, which is a really astounding piece of literature, but it doesn't really give you the tools to exist. But it does tell you, you know, the various prices for some very, very attractive tents.
And one or two ideal bathrooms, I would think, would be in there as well.
Well, exactly. This is where it all sprung from, you know, my ardent love for the Argos catalogue.
You say, Susanna, however, in the midst of all of that, you did say, oh, you know, nothing that extraordinary happens to her. She goes through, certainly in the middle section of the book, is told in three parts. In the middle section of that book, she goes through a pretty horrific experience.
She does, but, you know, I think kind of increasingly through, you know, people willing to relay lived experience and through art, we're gaining an insight into the ubiquity of these kinds of encounters and the trickiness of them and the ambiguity, like how tough it is to experience something and to try and assess your own victimhood and to see where you sit on this spectrum and the reluctance to identify as something that comes, you know, with its own very loaded terminology and its own anxieties and its own terrors.
I suppose we should explain, because if you haven't read the book, you don't know how horrific what happens to her is. She's raped and raped very violently. What age is she when that happens? Whether it's 17, isn't that the age she is? Yes.
Yeah, she's 17 when she's raped.
I mean, that is a pretty horrific experience. You're saying a part of what you're exploring in this book is just how ubiquitous that type of experience is for young women.
Yeah, because it's you know, it's one of these, like I said, more ambiguous encounters because it starts off in a scenario that is consensual and then it rapidly mutates into not consensual. And, you know, I think these are probably more common among young women than the sort of, because, you know, a book that informed me a great deal when I was writing it was Joyce Carol Oates's Rape, a Love Story, which is about a 12-year-old girl called Bethy Maguire, who is a witness to her mother being gang raped. And that's this very explicitly violent and horrific and gruesome event. And there's never any uncertainty about what it is that's taken place there. But then, you know, if you've been watching Michaela Cole's I May Destroy You, that's a show that explores the much trickier variety of sexual assault, the one that kind of abrogates easy categorization, the ones where something starts off as consensual and then mutates, or when there's you know, drugs involved, or you know, or when a condom is taken off without consent. You know, there's such a vast spectrum, and I think it's really tricky subsequently to place yourself and to actually work out within your own frame of reference what it is that's happened to you.
And while I don't want to get into the specifics in any way of the reasonably recent rape trial in Ulster, that must have been happening around the time that you were writing this book, or was the book fully written and finished at that point?
I started the book in January 2016, and then I guess that the Ulster Rugby trial was in 2018. So I was definitely still in the process of writing it, and you know, I'm again not to give too much away, but the protagonist in Tennis Lessons never, you know, goes to the authorities, never goes to the PSNI, and you know, I mean, a case like the Ulster Rugby rape trial really threw into kind of troubling acuity why people don't, you know.
Yeah, but we do need to be clear. Nobody, the defendants were acquitted in that case, and that is the reality.
Absolutely. I'm speaking more about what the reporting showed us about how the complainant was treated over the course of that trial. Which you know, I'm not going to comment at all on the result. But I think, you know, our justice system does not treat people who come forward with allegations of sexual assault kindly.
Which might explain to a large extent why it struck me that horrific. I must say, I found it horrendously difficult to read. It must have been difficult to write, I guess. But that's from that scene on. Suddenly, there really is almost a shift in the voice. And the young woman, whose name we never find out, by the way, and who always speaks to us in the second person, so, you know, she is referring to herself as you. You walk down the street, you sit on the chair, or whatever the particular line might be. It's incredibly difficult for her to talk to anybody about what happened.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I mean, the reason why I chose the second person to write it... And, you know, there's a short story by an American writer called Kiese Lehmann, and he has this short story called You Are the Second Person. And in it, the protagonist is put in a position of powerlessness by a literary editor. And at one point, the protagonist sits down, weeps, and starts writing something new. And they're really surprised to find out that they're writing in the second person. And the voice of the story then says, "You are the I to no one in the world, not even yourself." Yeah. And that, I think, is kind of the most succinct way of describing the effect of and the reason behind writing in the second person. And it's why I chose it, because I wanted to capture this idea that after an event like that, there's almost this internal fission where the protagonist is trying to distance herself from what has happened to her. She feels this increased sense of alienation from herself.
And of course, we as the reader are kind of implicated in that, because then we're telling her what happened to her as we read. Because if we say, "Your mother slams the door," she turns to you. It's almost as if we're telling her what happened rather than she telling us what happened. The other interesting aspect that I wanted to touch on just as we finish up, Susanna, is the fact that I mentioned award-winning poet Bloodthirsty for Marriage. Your collection won you the Eric Gregory Award, didn't it, for recently? And you were part of the Society of Authors Award. You got part of that prize fund as well. The shift from, or was it a shift from poetry to prose, or what's the relationship between the two?
I started off writing poetry. I started off writing, actually, prose poems, which are a really, really interesting form. And they have this lovely tradition of kind of subverting the expectations of both poetry and prose. There's no overt lyricism of poetry, but also it kind of teases this possibility of narrative and then thwarts that and exploits kind of grammatical expectations. And I think a lot of that I then brought to my prose, this kind of playing with language and this like surreal way of metabolizing kind of images and the world around you, which helped me write her because, you know, she is such an idiosyncratic thinker.
She certainly is that, and very, very interesting to read. What happens now? Do you go back to the poetry, or is there another novel, or do you know what's next?
There is going to be another novel, hopefully. I've finished a first draft of that, so we'll wait and see if it's any good. It's kind of like, you know, with writing, do you ever, you know how wombats produce cube-shaped poos?
I didn't know that, but I learn something new every night.
Yeah, it's to do with peristalsis and the kind of varying degrees of elasticity in their bowels. The waste gets shaped by encountering some areas of real unyielding rigidity and other areas of softness and acquiescence. And I guess that's kind of what it's like writing a novel. Sometimes it feels, you know, arduous and intransigent, and sometimes it's very soft and flowing.
Little did I think that we'd get from ideal bathrooms to wombat poos in the space of 12 minutes, but we did. There we go.
I wonder what a wombat's ideal bathroom is.
Well, there you go. That can be part of novel two as well. Listen, lovely to speak to you, Susanna, and congratulations on the debut novel and indeed on the success with the poetry as well. That's Susanna Dickey there speaking to us about the debut novel, Tennis Lessons, which is published by Doubleday. Tina Fey's hit NBC sitcom 30 Rock is coming together for a remotely produced special tonight in the US. The series ran for 7 seasons between 2006 and 2013 and was based on Fey's experience as head writer for Saturday Night Live. 30 Rock takes place behind the scenes of a fictional live sketch comedy show based at 30 Rockefeller Plaza in New York. Recently, Tina Fey requested several problematic episodes, which featured characters in what she called race-changing makeup, those episodes be removed from streaming platforms. So to look back at the series and to see how or if it remains relevant or is already starting to date, I'm joined now by Jen Gannon. Let's start with this is reunion episode that's going to take place tonight. This is kind of problematic in its own way. Is it just a publicity, bit of publicity thing going on here, Jen?
It kind of is. It's one of those things where I don't think these kind of reunions work. We saw that with the Parks and Recreation one recently for the over Zoom, the COVID kind of get together. And I think they're just like a toothless novelty, really. They don't add anything to the show's history or legacy, I don't think. And with this as well, it's almost an advertisement for NBC itself. So it's Dublin as an upfront, which is something that introduces the audience and would-be advertisers to their upcoming season. So not only are you getting the catch up with Jack and Liz, you're also kind of getting a subtle and not so subtle introduction to the new shows that are going to be on NBC next season.
Right, so it's basically a way of launching their new season.
It's a bit of an infomercial, but I think that's kind of, you know, it fits in with 30 Rock itself being a very meta comedy show. So I'm not surprised that that's the way that they've brought it back.
So it kind of works in within the setup of 30 Rock.
The realm because for me, 30 Rock, as you said, because it's based on Tina Fey's experiences and Saturday Night Live, it exists in this space for me between satire and surrealism, but it's kind of bound together by the spine of truth. And you know, I think if the thick of it is the ultimate skewering of political life and behind the scenes kind of skullduggery with the spin doctors and, you know, civil servants, I think 30 Rock is its counterpart for the entertainment industry, definitely.
Right. You mentioned Jack and Liz there. Jack is played by Alec Baldwin, and let's find out who Liz is, according to Jack. This is how he describes her at their first meeting.
I don't cook very much.
Sure, I got you. New York, third wave feminist, college educated, single and pretending to be happy about it, overscheduled, undersexed. You buy any magazine that says healthy body image on the cover, and every 2 years you take up knitting for a week.
Alec Baldwin as Jack, and Tina Fey getting a word in at the beginning of all of that. Is that a fair description of her character?
Yeah, I mean, even Tina Fey described her as a sexually frightened know-it-all, and I think that's what I love about Liz Lemon. For me, I think the greatest female comic character in history is Elaine Bennis from Seinfeld, and I think the reason why she's so good is because she's kind of sexless. She's de-sexed. Like, the rest of the characters in Seinfeld are all approximations of, you know, Larry David. And I think the thing about Liz Lemon is she's very female, but she's female in a way that we'd never seen before in a sitcom, nevertheless, like a star of a sitcom. Like, she wasn't the shiny haired girl next door that was looking for a man, or who was, you know, just the butt of the guy's jokes. She was flawed, a really flawed character. And she was allowed to be, you know, Liz Lemon is smart, acerbic, difficult, very difficult. And, you know, is addicted to junk food. It makes terrible choices in men, as you see throughout the series.
She's just a lot of breakups, doesn't she?
With, you know, the lovable idiot that was played by John Hamm, Dr. Drew, and as well with Dennis Duffy, who keeps on reappearing into her life, and he is just the worst match for her. And she's just really socially inept, but there's something about her that there wasn't this limitation of, you know, sexiness. You had to appeal to a broad spectrum of men. That's not what 30 Rock was about. And there's something really universal. For me, like, I think about Liz Lemon, the character lying on the couch in her slanket, eating her night cheese, singing to herself. And that was never explored before about women, apart from, let's say, the Mary Tyler Moore Show. But since then, really not. And I think there's a modern loneliness to the character Liz, who wants, there's this whole thing about wants to have it all, but ends up just having a sandwich. That is, you know, it speaks to a lot of women and a lot of men about this modern loneliness that we now see in shows like High Maintenance and Russian Doll. But, you know, Tina Fey had a damn pop with Liz Lemon.
Yeah, I think you get a sense of that. And this is one of those famous breakups. And Jenna, played by Jean Krakowski.
Yeah, where does Jane she fit Gagazzi. Into the... Jenna is one of the best comic creations, I think, in the past 20 years. She is a monster. She is like the twin ego, her and Tracy Jordan. They're both stars of TGS, and they're both, you know, always on the edge of sanity. And Liz, it's up to Liz and the producers and the writers to kind of pull them back from that, from, you know, always exiting the show. And she's basically any kind of fear that an actress has had, like Tina Fey wrote it into the character of Jenna as this kind of person who's always afraid that she's going to be replaced, and she's aging and everyone hates her.
So appearance is vitally important to her, which we get, and we get a sense of that in this clip where Jenna is questioning Liz, Tina Fey's character, about her appearance after another breakup.
Listen up, everyone. I have an announcement to make. As you may have heard, Carol and I broke up last week.
Hang on. Why do you have a cat? And a fanny pack. And your ponytail. It's being held up by a chip clip.
Because I'm giving up, Jenna. I did the math. How many times does a woman meet Mr. Right? I've had three chances. Floyd, then Carol, and I was once in an elevator with Tom Brokaw, and I blew all three. Opportunities. So I am making my graceful transition into spinsterhood. I have adopted this cat, named her Emily Dickinson. Oh. Named her Emily Dickinson.
Lemon, a word. Hang on. Recent breakup, fanny pack, cat. Quick, who is the lead character on NCIS?
Special Agent Jethro Gibbs.
In your office now.
What's the point, Jack? I'm done. I took the money I was saving for my honeymoon and I bought a cemetery plot. I also joined a book club at the senior center near my home. We're reading Murder on the Orient Express.
You know there's a movie of that, right?
I did not.
Liz, played by Tina Fey. We heard Alec Baldwin there as Jack again in that, and Jenna played by Jane Krakowski at the beginning of that. Jen Gannon speaking to us about 30 Rock ahead of their special episode tonight, which we think might be an excuse to launch NBC's new season. I mentioned that we've spoken about Jack a couple of times. Where does he fit into it, the Alec Baldwin character? And is it Liz's story, or is it Liz's and Jack's story, or is it everybody's story? This,
it's, you know, mostly Liz's story. It's from her perspective. But then, you know, Liz and Jack have this great relationship, which I think is great in a sitcom sense, because they're not on again, off again lovers, or they're not will they, won't they. They're strictly a mentor and a mentee, and he finds her fascinating because she's bizarre to him. And he's like this swaggering, selfish, you know, he's a conservative. He's totally into that culture. And I think the genius that Tina Fey is, she tapped into that Alec Baldwin that we know from Glengarry Glen Ross, which I think is his best role, but also that hothead that we know from his divorce from King Basinger when he was, you know, completely acrimonious divorce and left terrible voicemails on his daughter's answering machine. So she tapped into that kind of aggression that he has and that very, you know, precise masculinity. And that's a huge part of their kind of dynamic as well, which I think is great. It's a really interesting dynamic that they
have. And when you say mentor-mentee, does the mentor-mentee role, does that shift from one to the other?
It does in some parts of it, and she kind of, but also he always has the upper hand because he is the white male, the straight white man, and that's what she's trying to always pin into 30 Rock is the fact that no matter how much Liz tries and gets opportunities, it's always, you know, going to be at the end of the day the straight white man's decision. And that's what happened to her in Saturday Night Live. Like, she had went through experiences where there were writers and well-known writers and well-known, you know, actors on Saturday Night Live that get, you know, put her through hell and basically said women aren't funny and women will never be funny. And I think her having her own show and the control of her own show and writing a character like Liz was a huge step forward, and I think influenced a lot of other women auteurs, like you see Phoebe Waller-Bridge now, or the girls from Broad City, Ilana Glazer and Abby Jacobson, and, you know, even someone like Issa Rae with Insecure. They're all gone on to have their own shows written by them and starring them, and I think without 30 Rock you wouldn't have that.
What do you make of the, you know, this whole idea in the wake of the Black Lives Matter movement, obviously Tina Fey coming under criticism for episodes in 30 Rock, which featured blackface, and she called it race changing makeup. How did she handle that?
She doesn't handle it well at all, and she never has. She's spent years ignoring, you know, outright ridiculing critiques of her writing when it comes to race. And I think by removing these episodes, you know, it might save some viewers an offensive experience, but what it actually is doing, I think, is conveniently taking Faye out of a conversation, you know, where it has arisen all the time about the complications of race within 30 Rock. And I think she's opting out of having to have this conversation, which I think is very important. And instead of doing what Mad Men are doing and inserting, say, a card before the episode and explaining why this was happening, they're not doing that. So they're removing it and putting a full stop on a conversation that really should have a question mark. And she should have to answer for that, why there was four separate episodes of blackface in them, which, you know, should never have happened.
And will you be watching the launch tonight? You can't.
I don't think I need to. I think, like, you know, the best 30 Rock episodes, if you want to go back, watch season 3, season 4, they're the pinnacle of like such good comedy episodes. And, you know, something like The Bubble or The C Word, they're all, or, you know, TGS Hates Women, I think they're all the ones that are the glory of the show and do what it does best.
How cool was it when Carrie Fisher made the appearance?
Carrie Fisher is one of, like, she's so good at bringing all these undervalued female actresses back. And Carrie Fisher played her idol, Rosemary Howard. And it gave Jack a great line saying, you know, never go with a hippie to a second location. Yep. And, you know, Rosemary Howard ended up being a writer that goes off the rails. And she was kind of making the point is that's what happens to women over a certain age. If they're undervalued and not respected, they leave Hollywood, they leave the industry and become crazy.
Let's leave the last words to Carrie Fisher then as that forgotten writer.
You know, I think I should go home before it gets dark.
You can't abandon me, Liz. You are me.
No, I'm not you.
Really? You pick up guys that are smart and funny, and they leave you for someone less complicated. You're never gonna get married, Liz. You're married to your job.
Oh my God, I lost my job.
You're just like me. You get up in the morning and smoke weed.
No, I don't.
You obsess about the Jamaican man across the hall.
Oh my God, I lost my job.
You wouldn't have a job if it wasn't for me. I broke barriers for you.
I really have to go.
I sat around while my junk went bad. All for you. I didn't have any kids. You're my kid. You're my kid that never calls.
Yikes.
Help me, Liz Levitt. You're my only hope.
Ah, the wonderful Carrie Fisher there in that scene from 30 Rock. Jen Gannon speaking to us about 30 Rock ahead of the reunion episode, which airs tonight in America. And all 7 seasons will be available on Sky, or currently are available, rather, on Sky On Demand. Seasons 3 and 4, is that where you told us to go, Jen?
3 and 4 are the best ones, yeah.
3 and 4, if you just want to go in and have a look. That is our lot for this evening. Liam Murphy and Paula Shields research. Janice Furphy was the broadcast coordinator. Paddy Carney was on sound this evening. And tonight's programme was produced by Old McGon.